Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 41, and I'm your host, Nick Ortigo. A new brain scan study reveals exactly how positive activity can affect the brain. A nationwide school walkout happened this week, but what's the end game? And was Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's 60 Minutes interview as bad as it looked? Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak and hear from a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, which teacher changed your life? It's a question we ask all of our guests on this show, and it invokes some really thoughtful and touching answers. Today, we've compiled them all. Hello, everybody. Nick Ortigo here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, how's it going over there?
It's going great, man.
Lissa, have you seen the wallaby?
No, I looked for it, though.
So, Russ, I sent Lissa a story last night. Apparently, the local news just posted it. Somebody had a pet wallaby, and it was last spotted, like, right outside Lissa's neighborhood. So, I had to ask if she's seen it, because that'd be pretty cool to see, a little wallaby.
The photo you sent me was, like, I knew exactly where it was, like, with the street lamps and the fence. And I was like, oh, my gosh. At first, I thought it was a joke, because even the way the story was written, it was pretty comical.
Right.
He was like, this is Jeff, the wallaby. He's scared and alone, and he's missing.
Oh, wow. I just pulled up the news. So this is, I think you live in the opposite side of the subdivision I used to live in, I think.
That's right. That's right.
I know exactly where that is.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
So someone around there lost their wallaby, and as far as we know, it has not been found. So if you are in the Hattiesburg, Mississippi area, and you see an Australian animal
hopping down the side of West 4th, then you know exactly what's happened.
Right.
I actually went to a neighbor's house last night and was driving back a little late, and I found myself looking around for the wallaby.
I mean, you might find it.
What would I do? Be like, hey, they said it likes bananas. It makes me think, what was it that used to have a kangaroo boxing and would like knock people out? It makes me think, I guess maybe a Funniest Home Video. I thought, is that how I'm going to go out?
Yeah, a wallaby is essentially like a smaller kangaroo.
I know that.
Yeah. Well, I know, but I did not know that
until I just read, he's a wallaby, parentheses, small kangaroo.
It makes me think of the Seinfeld episode with the dingo. The dingo ate your baby.
Maybe the dingo ate your baby. Yeah.
But you can't explain the Seinfeld episode. So, Lissa, why don't we go ahead and jump into the teacher's lounge? What do you know?
Well, it turns out that a positive attitude gets you farther than you think. There's some research that's been done that says that if you have more of a positive outlook as far as students. I know. I'm really happy to present this talking with you two guys. I think anybody that listens to this podcast.
We are the pictures of positivity.
No, I am. I'm the ray of sunshine in this. But it's true that your outlook, referring to children in the classroom, if they have more of a positive outlook as far as subject matter, they, hook these kids up to these little probes and measured,
So this is actually like brain study. This isn't just like,
yes, it is.
I have a theory.
So there's another part of the brain that ignites also at the same time that, things like IQ and recall and things like that. There's another part of the brain that is igniting if you have more of a positive outlook towards what you're doing at the moment. So, for example, a math student that feels that they're good at math, that's been told that they're good at math, whose family is a math-minded family, they are not just pulling from certain parts of the brain that ignite math, reasoning and skills. There's also this other part of the brain that has to do with your attitude that is also lighting up and that is also causing, they're saying it is this positive outlook and positive ignition is almost as powerful as your IQ.
So you're basically saying if I think I'm smarter, I will be smarter almost. Like if I have that attitude.
If you think not, I mean, you may know that you have some setbacks mathematically over your brother.
Right.
But if you have more of a positive outlook as I'm going to get there, instead of just saying math's not my thing. Yeah. I'm not good at math. You know, when I taught math, middle school math too, so that's a tough crowd, you know. There's a lot of jokes that fall flat in that class. You know, everybody just stares at you.
Yeah, tell us a math joke. What do you know?
Whatever.
Okay.
I have a lot of math jokes. But I started the year by saying to the students and parents, you know, some of you in here say, I'm good at math or I like math. And some of you in here say, I'm not good at math. And some of your parents say, oh, I was never good at math.
Right.
And I said, the difference is actually everybody's good at math. There's just a part of it that is more your style than another. But if you really look at the true spectrum of math, there's going to be some parts that are your jam, and there's going to be some parts that are not so, that don't come as easily to you. So if you look at it that way, as yes, I am good at math, there's just certain parts that I get a little quicker than others.
Right.
Then you can kind of change your mindset, and we can this year explore those areas and figure out, okay, what's separating you from greatness, and what should we go at, and what is easy street for you? And so really and truly at the end of the year, I had several parents and teachers say, my child doesn't feel like they're not good at math anymore. They have a different mindset. So I do believe that the power of positivity works.
I mean, Russ, you know why I like this, and I think you'll agree, because when you manage people sometimes, you kind of get in a rut and you may have a negative attitude, but maybe if you just go into managing people, you know, in this positive attitude that we can accomplish anything, that really can change the result of your team. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think a lot of this has to do with, there's a lot of studies right now talking about grit, right? Like perseverance and teaching that to children, and how do we get that across to folks, and having some sort of struggle, you know, in their life creates an inner drive that some folks say, you know, we don't do a good job of teaching anymore. So I would imagine that this study kind of rounds out about that, like, you know, instead of just giving up, they continue to try to persevere and try to solve the problems. And I think attitude is important. I mean, I know sometimes we joke and we're negative on the show, but, you know, I can tell you that in our organization, if I have a bad day, or like if I'm in a down mood, it affects the entire organization. I can tell it in about, it takes about 48 hours to kind of ripple down to folks. But, and a lot of that is just because I don't hide my emotion very well. So if I'm not in a great mood, or things aren't going well, or, you know, we screwed up in some way, you know, which happens in every company, then definitely it kind of, you know, affects the work quality in the future. And you really, you know, as somebody that leads an organization, you really have to work, you know, extra hard, that even if things aren't going exactly as you want them to, which they rarely are, then it's you know, it's important that doesn't necessarily, that isn't the news that gets out to the troops, right?
Right.
The news needs to be that things are positive, things are going well. And 9 times out of 10, that's exactly what's happening. It's a small setback in a otherwise, you know, great path. So I agree. I mean, I think that there is something to be said about positivity. I don't think, you know, I think there's a limit to it, right? Because if everybody that thought they were good at something was good at something, I mean, I think that's how we got our U.S. Congress, right? Like, everybody thinks they're great at something, you know, making laws and whatever the case may be. And so, and it turns out they're not very productive. So I think it's kind of the same thing. I think there's a natural limit to it. But I think as far as helping you get through to solve, because there really are few things more satisfying to me than working on a problem for a while and finally getting it worked out. It doesn't have to be necessarily a math problem, but working through something, figuring out a good solution, and owning that from soup to nuts, you understand the issue and know how to prevent it from happening again. For me, there's a great sense of accomplishment.
Okay, so back to the classroom, though. This is, I think it dials down to real language that parents are using with their children and that the teachers are using with their students. So, for example, if you're a parent out there that feels like, I was never good at math in school. If your children grow up hearing you say those things, if your child makes a poor grade on a math test and you want to give them a break by saying, yeah, you know what, math was never my thing either, that you're setting up negative outcomes. You're setting up a negative attitude. But I can see when parents say that to children, they're thinking, well, I'm just helping them out by making them, you know, that's okay, buddy. But the truth is, any teacher would tell you in any subject matter, because for one of my children, language and reading comprehension seems to be one of his little bugaboos, okay? But that's such a broad general term. So any teacher would tell you that there's specific skills that are lacking that end up making someone feel that they're not good at this, that, or the other. A lot of times in math, it's division. It's going backwards. It's in reverse. So division is fractions. So if anybody says, oh gosh, you know, oh, fractions, I'm not good at fractions. Actually, they're probably not so great at division, probably. Okay. That's probably where it boiled down to. So as a teacher, to help have more of a positive outlook and as a parent, don't say, well, you did your best. You know, that was your best in math, and we're just not math-minded people. You know, your dad's the same way. Your mom's the same way. You know, don't say things like that. Say, well, let's look at this test, and you missed five questions, but I bet you all five of those questions have something in common. So let's find out what it is, and let's attack that, and let's get better at that.
Well, it's certainly good to see some science backing up the power of positivity, so... Good stuff. You guys know I go through hours of educational news stories every week, just kind of in preparation for the show and trying to keep an idea of what's out there. And two stories have dominated the education headlines this week so much that it was even hard to find a third story. and those two stories have been related to the national school walkout, and the other is related to Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. So, Russ, I'm going to let you kick things off with the walkout that took place this week.
Sure. So we're actually recording this on the 15th. And so yesterday was the 1 month anniversary of the school shooting that happened in Florida at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. And there were students at 3,000 schools that walked out yesterday. And it's, I don't know if it's the largest show of solidarity that we've seen in a school, but it is a fairly large show of that. And I was kind of amazed, and as I was reading through the stories, prepping for this, prepping for the show, and yes, folks, occasionally we do prep for this show. I was kind of amazed at the kind of dichotomous ways that schools handled it. Right. So there was some folks on Twitter that said that their child was given an option. They walked out and in support of the students, and they were given an option of internal ISS, which is like, you know, internal suspension, or corporal punishment, right? Which yeah. I didn't even know. I mean, it's still a thing, I guess, but it's probably not a very good idea. And of course, they chose corporal punishment instead of ISS. And so these children, for, you know, kind of exerting their First Amendment rights, the school district kind of took a very strong hand and hit them, right. Which I think is probably the wrong way to handle that. Other places, use it as a lesson, right? They had the government, the civics teacher, the government teacher out there talking about, you know, the rights free association and you know, a lot of schools embraced it. So I saw a lot of local schools that, you know, had the students come out on the football field, they'd set up a podium for them so they could speak about it. And really what the students are trying to accomplish is they're trying to accomplish some sort of meaningful reform that will help curb the violence. And I think a lot of the times folks get caught up in whether it's gun, Second Amendment, or not Second Amendment, or whatever the case is. I think people are just asking for something. And there was a particular article that I read while I was prepping that talked about, you know, we also had this terrible incident with United Airlines where they put an animal in the overhead bin and the animal died. And then there was another event that happened that was similar to that. And Congress has already introduced a bill to ban putting animals in overhead
bins. Right, it was Senator Kennedy out of Louisiana, who actually is a very strong education proponent, I will say,
sure.
Ironically. But yeah, he was taking some heat for proposing that bill, I think.
Yeah, I think kind of the optics of that, and while there have been some proposals, there's nothing that's been really taken seriously in Congress. And I think, you know, essentially they've moved on. And that's what they've said is that, hey, we're going to move on to these other things that we feel like can make a difference. And we're going to have a study committee. And I think, you know, you were talking about Secretary DeVos a second ago, potentially leading this, you know, government study on how to improve school safety. I got to be honest with you. I don't think Americans can suffer through another study of how this stuff happens.
Oh, this bothers me as a teacher. I'm just sitting here like massaging my shoulders with tension. I do think that the higher-ups in administration have forgotten who they work for, which is the children. That is their golden egg. And I have worked in school districts where we had a student take their own life. And across the school, even people that didn't know the student, there were support personnel, there were public announcements, their children were allowed to go to the gym to speak out about how it made them feel, whether they knew the child or not, any anxiety that came from it. Same thing happened after 9/11. I remember teaching, and we had a day set aside to deal with that.
You're saying class was disrupted.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was something, you know, many times that didn't affect truly our school. So this, in my opinion, I don't understand why you would schedule an event like a tornado drill that would say, oh, you're in violation of something that we have going on at this exact time, or why you would punish a child for, you know, exercising a walkout or whatever, when other situations happen that are traumatic.
I think 9/11 is actually a pretty fair comparison.
Right. It's very traumatic, but definitely distant from where my school was.
Right.
Certainly not age appropriate for the children that we were teaching, young children here, but we still had open discussions way back then. We had an open forum in the gym for the older children that wanted to speak out. Everybody, no matter how old or young you are, they want to be heard. They want to feel like they were heard. No matter how insignificant you may think that their feelings about this distant situation are, they have the need to want to be heard, mainly because they're scared. That's
right.
It. Mainly, and they're children. So let's, you guys out there that are maybe not moving on an issue, or maybe you're handling it in a way that a teacher or a child doesn't think is right. You may think that this is disruptive, but you've forgotten who you're dealing with. You're dealing with children, and they're scared. And yep, it didn't happen in their school. It didn't happen in their state. Nope, it didn't. But neither did 9/11. And we all banded together after 9/11, everybody, and said, whoa, let's take a moment. Whoa, this was an attack on just our way of life. And yep, this happened 30 days ago. And unfortunately, of course, it's still in the news and it's still a buzz. And so Nick was saying, I don't think this is going away. Well, you know what I'm saying? No, you know what? It's not going away, because there's going to be another one, because history's proven that.
Right.
So it's not going away. So something else is going to happen, and here we'll go again. And I feel like if you have students that are wanting to speak out and wanting to speak up, and they feel like, hey, it could be us next. Hey, this bothers us, even if it's not us next. You should be embracing conversations. You should have support staff there. You should have an open mic, open forum in the gym for people to be able to say what they want. No matter what side of the fence they're speaking on, they should be allowed to speak. This affects them, absolutely affects them.
Right. Well, certainly something that we'll continue to watch and see how it plays out. You know, that other story that I was talking about was our education secretary, Betsy DeVos, was interviewed by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes Sunday. And if you woke up Monday morning, the clips, the sound bites, they were everywhere, all over other news agencies, all over Twitter.
Have the public schools in Michigan gotten better?
I don't know. Overall, I can't say overall that they have all gotten better.
The whole state is not doing well.
Well, there are certainly lots of pockets where the students are doing well.
But your argument that if you take funds away, that the schools will get better is not working in Michigan, where you had a huge impact and influence over the direction of the school system here.
I hesitate to talk about all schools in general, because schools are made up of individual students attending them.
The public schools here are doing worse than they did.
Michigan schools need to do better. There is no doubt about it.
Have you seen the really bad schools? Maybe try to figure out what they're doing?
I have not intentionally visited schools that are underperforming.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should.
I think even any nonpartisan observer would say she came across kind of looking ill-informed, and Leslie Stahl looked very prepared. And and it just really reflected poorly on the education secretary and the department. But I'm going to kind of come at this with a different perspective. I'm going to throw this out there, and I want to remind people that there's a GOP bill to terminate the Department of Education. And there have been countless candidates who have openly said during running for president that they would do away with the department. And I think what we're seeing here isn't so much, you know, somebody who's ill-informed and not knowing how to run the department. I think we're watching somebody dismantle a department. And so there really isn't even any concern to be informed about education because they're just worried about dismantling it. And I think it's the same thing we're seeing take place with the EPA, with Scott Pruitt. We're watching that whole department be taken apart. And because it's much easier to dismantle something than just do away with something. So I kind of think her lack of knowledge in the world of education is kind of part of the plan.
You know, this is one of the, I think, in recent memory, one of the more ill-prepared political appointments that's cabinet level that I've seen in an administration. And so, you know, sometimes ambassadors get put, you know, if you're the ambassador to Uruguay or, you know, Panama or, you know, somewhere like that, you know, like a lot of the times those are stacked with political cronies, basically people that were active in the campaign that gave a bunch of money, that sort of thing. But a lot of policymaking happens in education at the federal level, and it comes in the form of non-regulatory guidance and other forms of interpretation. So laws are written very broad ways, and then they're subject to interpretation kind of at the federal level. And then they send out what are called Dear Colleague letters, which go out to states and or SEAs, state educational administrations, and LEAs, which are local education administrations, which are schools, basically districts. And a lot of work happens there. And
well, I mean, they have a $68 billion budget, just for the record. I mean, they're a huge agency.
I understand what you're saying. I would tend not to agree in that I don't think that, and this is going to sound bad, but I don't think that this administration thinks that far ahead. I don't think that they're playing 3D chess. I think that Betsy DeVos was the, quote, education person because she was, you know, born wealthy and then married even wealthier and has spent a lot of time talking about the subject in her home state of Michigan and has turned Michigan into an incubator for the subject. And I think it just shows how people live in a, I think the interview showed more than anything how much people live in a vacuum,
I think
an echo chamber.
I think
she was not prepared for the question.
She wasn't prepared. And I think people are like, you should know this stuff. You should know this stuff.
Leslie Stahl's a tough interview.
But I think that the whole point is that she really doesn't have to know this stuff because her mission isn't to, you know, have this great overarching national education guidance. Her mission is to basically dismantle the department and allow school choice all across the country because that was her big push in Michigan.
But I think if you're going to do that, I think she went about it in an extraordinarily bad way, which is not being able to defend school choice. I think Leslie Stahl.
You're right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where she screwed up. If that's her job, she failed miserably at it because Leslie was asking her directly about the state that you live in, and it really hasn't shown a lot of progress. And I'm sure that there are like think tanks in Michigan and all over the place that are just slapping their heads going, oh my God, lady, come on, talk about this district or talk about that district. I'm sure there are examples, but in mass, has school choice been great for Michigan? Leslie Stahl doesn't think so. And that's the resounding thing that got out of the interview because Secretary DeVos, who is a big proponent of this thing, was not prepared.
I mean, there are people out there who believe that there shouldn't be a Department of Education. And in fact, there really wasn't one in modern time until 1980, I think, is when it started back up. But Ted Cruz ran on the fact that he would abolish it. Mike Huckabee, who ran for president, called for getting rid of it. Rand Paul called for getting rid of it. Rubio called for getting rid of it. Donald Trump, when he was running, he was like, well, I certainly think it's too big. Might get rid of it. He said, we might just, you know, slim it down. So I think the whole idea that I just don't think it's a priority to the administration. And by putting somebody who isn't that informed, it's kind of part of their plan. They're like, we don't care. Like, I don't care what happens. What shouldn't have happened is that interview with 60 Minutes. Like, she should have never agreed to that. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's maybe was their slip up. So you kind of publicly see it. But I think if you're the president right now or a lot of, you know, GOP leaders, you're kind of like, oh, well.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you've got a guy running HUD that has no idea what HUD does. You've got a guy running the Department of Energy that couldn't name it during a debate.
Right.
I'm not just beating up on folks. I'm saying that now that I think about it, there's probably some logic to your argument because there are a lot of folks running these, you know, like Department of Energy, it's alleged that Governor Perry didn't understand that the Department of Energy was responsible for our nuclear weapons stockpile.
Right, or the EPA, I forget Scott Pruitt's background, but it is not an environmental-friendly background, you know?
No, it's been fighting the EPA in Oklahoma, and that's where he came from. So, you know, again, I'm not trying to wade into the politics here, but typically the folks that you put in charge of an organization haven't spent the last, you know, 5 or 6 years fighting it in federal court, and the... You know, the person who's responsible for public education hasn't been trying to dismantle it by way of vouchers or school choice or whatever the case may be. So regardless of what your, you know, political leanings are, I think that you definitely, for the sake of the students out there and the people that receive HUD grants and, you know, community development block grants and all that stuff that flows through HUD, I think you definitely want at least somebody that understands what the department does before you put them in that position. Also, the Senate plays a role in this. The president can only appoint somebody to a Senate-confirmable position with the advice and consent of the United States Senate, which everybody that we've talked about has passed. So it's not just the president appointing these folks. It's the people not holding the administration accountable for the qualifications of the people that they put in these positions. You know, I'm sure you could go back and find examples of such in previous administrations as well if you wanted to go the political junket.
Right.
But I think we could all agree that if you're going to be the proponent of school choice, that's fine. I would argue that you probably don't need to be the Secretary of Education. But if you are, you sure as hell should be able to talk about the good things that are going on with it.
Right.
And I think she did the movement a great disservice.
So when we do our pop quiz every week, you guys listen to it, you know, with our guests, and we ask them a bunch of questions, what's the favorite question, in your opinion, that we ask them?
The teacher that made the biggest difference.
Yep.
That's what I was going to say, too.
That's mine, too. So what I've done is, for the Bright Ideas segment, is I have pulled together that answer of everyone we have interviewed.
Oh, cool.
And I just feel like there's so much insight into the way these teachers answer that question, or whether they're scientists or teachers or college professors or whoever. You really get into almost an emotional connection with the person because they're having to reflect on that teacher that changed their life, and now they're an amazing educator. I just feel like you almost can learn of how to be a better teacher just mm-hmm. by listening to these answers. So I wanted everyone to just hear all of them next to each other. So
and maybe for a follow-up episode in the future, the three of us could talk about our favorite teachers as well.
Right.
I certainly have two I know that changed my life forever.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't be here without him.
And I would argue everyone's homework should be to send a thank you letter, if possible, to that teacher. I feel like that would be, because, you know, everyone kind of talks about that teacher that changed your life, but does that teacher know? And unless they listen to the Class Dismissed podcast, they probably don't know. So, you know, send them a letter. Anyhow, check this
awesome.
Out. Which teacher changed your life?
So Mrs. Brown, she was my 7th grade English teacher, and I wanted to walk like her, talk like her, dress like her, smell like her. I wanted to be Mrs. Brown. And she taught me 7th and 8th grade language arts in Wichita Falls, Texas. I just lived there for 3 years, and 2 of those years I was blessed to have her. I tried to find her after I grew up and became a teacher,
yeah.
And she had already passed on. But I just have to believe that somewhere she knows that I think about her every single day. I still have all the notebooks from her class. I have every paper I ever did for her.
I had a teacher for math for 3 years named Mr. Hibbard at New Milford High School, and Mr. Hibbard was just a great person. He was a great role model. He would tell me straight up if I did something wrong. He would also hide me if I did something wrong. And what was really great about it is I had him the last 3 years of high school. So I'm in his calculus class, and what was really cool was he had shared with me all these stories that we built up, and he was telling me about how his wife reacted to him, and I'm like, why does that matter? And then I found out she was my first grade teacher. And I was like, oh, my gosh,
wow.
That is wild.
That is wild.
So, and he had a little note and everything, how proud she was of me, how I grew and everything. I'm like, oh, gosh, the heart's just getting pulled.
Yeah.
It was great.
No doubt.
That one's easy. My 4th grade teacher, I was an extremely shy kid who never spoke up. And my 4th grade teacher knew I was a science nerd at some level. And she actually sent me home with these little science projects that were like kits.
Mm-hmm.
And then she asked me to teach the class electricity. So in 4th grade, we built batteries that I actually taught my 4th grade class. And that teacher got me out of my shell. I wonder if I would be a scientist without her.
Wow, and look where we are today.
And yeah, who would have imagined I would have gone to MIT and started this whole program, and she's the one. I mean,
her name is Dolly Jamail, and I actually wrote about her on a piece connected to the Aussie article, actually. She was my mentor teacher my first year teaching.
What'd she do that really stuck out with you?
She taught me how to survive. She taught me how to create subplans. She taught me how to engage my students while we were walking in line. She taught me how to do everything. I mean, she completely denies it, but I owe my finishing my first year to Dolly Jamail.
Well, this is going to be a biased answer, and I'm going to say it was my mother, because my mother was an elementary school teacher.
Well, that's great.
And,
yeah.
And I actually got the benefit of her dual role, if you will. Before I started my K through 12 education, I would sit sometimes in her first and second grade classes and kind of got a leg up that way. Of course, there was no conflict of interest. I wasn't actually in the same school once I started, but having that benefit, I think, was personally a great one.
The teacher that changed my life was my eighth grade teacher, Miss Crossan. She's the one that gave me confidence. I owe her a lot of what I have come out to be today. So
that's good. I'm finding that confidence is a general theme with the answer to that question as we ask people. It's really kind of inspiring, actually.
Yeah, it's very, you know, it's really interesting. I'm hearing impaired. So I found out that I was hearing impaired when I was in the fifth grade. And my hearing started getting worse throughout the years. And when I made it to the eighth grade, I got bullied all the time. And I said to my teacher, I'm like, I'm just going to grow up and end up working at like a job, you know, that only people with disabilities have. And she's like, no, you can do whatever you want. Don't listen to anyone. And I was like, well, I don't understand, you know, how that could be possible because I have a disability. She's like, you show them that they're all wrong. And so I did.
I had a phenomenal sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Reed, who had a huge enthusiasm for learning. And she used to sing songs and come up with rhymes. And she made learning just fun and amazing, and I think she was really inspiring to me as I decided to make teaching my own career.
My 10th grade world history teacher, Stephen Castle, he really challenged me. I was kind of a difficult student in high school, and he challenged me and kind of turned me around educationally.
Teacher who changed my life is my partner, Wendy Goldfein.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, she actually, has many more years experience than me. I actually met her through her teaching my own children. And when I went back to school to become a teacher myself, I feel like I was lucky enough to kind of be taken under her wing. And we team taught in individual classrooms, but worked a lot together on curriculum. And it was through that relationship that we decided to form our company.
Greta Nutt, my fourth grade teacher. I'll never forget, some of the kids had kind of made fun of me a little bit. I forget who it was, but I was in the hallway crying. I was called a flunker. I'd been held back in school, and I just so sad. I just felt like a failure. I remember that distinctly. And I was crying, and Miss Nutt came up to me, and this was the teacher who used puppets and did all these things with me, and I just told her what was going on, and she looked at me and she said, "Jim, you are smart. You know that? You're a smart boy. And you're going to be okay. And you are reading. You're reading the pictures. And we're talking about it. And you're getting some of the words. Let's talk about some of those words, you know." I never felt so good. That was probably one of the most critical conversations I needed in my life. And I still reflect on that. And I've actually thanked her for her kindness.
My high school math teacher was also my basketball coach, John Ehrlich, and he was someone I would say has changed my life, just being a great figure of what it is to be a man and what it is to be responsible and take on responsibility and adapt in situations and be successful.
I did have a teacher who assigned us It was actually a student teacher who assigned us to keep a dream journal. And I can trace the moment that I started becoming a writer to the moment I started carrying that composition book called The Dream Journal in my backpack and just writing in it whenever I had a thought.
Mr. Hallstrom.
How so?
He just made learning so fun, and he made it feel purposeful and meaningful.
I'm going to have to say my 7th and 8th grade Spanish teacher, Mrs. Worley. She just kept me interested in learning Spanish as my second language, kept me involved. She was a lot of fun. She had a lot of energy as well. And she came to my going away party when I studied abroad in Spain. I was already in college, a junior in college, and she was my 7th and 8th grade Spanish teacher. And my mom tracked her down and found her, and she came to my bon voyage party.
Oh, it has to be my 12th grade AP calculus teacher, Frances Allen. I haven't talked to Mrs. Allen in probably 30 years since I was in high school. Mrs. Allen's approach to calculus was real simple. You see the DNA of her teaching and my teaching today. And she had this way of explaining things to us in lecture that were just very, very brief and to the point and simple. And then what was wonderful about her was she knew when to get out of the way. She would teach us for a little while, lecture to us for a little while, maybe like 15 minutes, and then just stop and not talk anymore and just say, okay, here's some stuff for you to do.
Man, I'm glad you asked that. I haven't thought about him in quite a while. His name was Mike Jones, and he taught a gifted class, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, for me, so all throughout middle school. And the reason he sticks out in my mind is because he let me be me. He let me be the weirdo adolescent boy that I was. And he had much higher expectations for me than the majority of my other teachers. And he accepted work that was outside the norm.
It was probably my first grade teacher, Miss Brandenburg, just made me really love reading, and that really impacted my life.
I think the one who had the biggest impact on me was my first mentor. I was kind of thrown into a crash course, so I had 4 classes, I had a semester of student teaching, and then suddenly somebody handed me my own classroom of 27 students, and so the biggest piece for me was having that mentor who said to me on the first day, every decision that you ever make needs to be in the best interest of a child. And, you know, that was nearly 14 years ago at this point. And I try to live those words every day and try to make every decision in the best interest of children.
Miss Lowney.
Why is that?
I don't remember a lot of my teachers in high school. I had a lot of competing priorities, but I wasn't a big reader until 11th grade. And then I was in Miss Lowney's English class, and she made me read A Prayer for Owen Meany, which looked like as thick as the Bible. And that book is what made me a reader, and I ultimately believe put me on a course to enter education.
I would have to say the teacher that probably most impacted my thinking and writing is my current colleague, former teacher, history teacher from 11th grade and 12th grade, who really taught me to write and think and be analytical. So I'd have to go with that.
Since I'm an elementary teacher, I'm going to say my 2nd grade teacher, because I was a painfully shy kid in elementary school, and she was the first one that made a personal connection with me where I realized she's actually a real person, not this, you know, mythical being that only lives inside the classroom.
Oh, that's easy. Mr. Mills, 7th grade. He completely turned my world on the end because he was the first teacher I ever had that stopped, and he would put the curriculum aside periodically, and we would just talk. And he actually taught me about the musical stylings of Eric Clapton. And I've never, ever forgotten Mr. Mills for that very reason.
Mine's actually a librarian, and it's a Miss Davis. And we had two of the first computers in the area at our school, and you couldn't get time on them. They were in the library, and she would allow me to skip lunch and occasionally skip a class and sneak in and start playing around and learning how to program, even though in some cases I shouldn't have been there. You know, she recognized how thirsty I was for that type of learning. So she pushed me enough and gave me opportunities to do things that I wouldn't have done, and that led me to a great career in computers, which led me to aviation.
Mr. Beeson, who was my, and I didn't even realize it till much later, but he was my both my calculus teacher and my computer programming teacher in high school, and he allowed us to, you know, create something in programming BASIC, and I was able to create a game, and I didn't realize till years later that that's probably was extremely influential, but when I look back at it, I'm like, wow, you know, that was such a great experience.
Oh, I had a third grade teacher named Mrs. Beebleheimer.
That's a great
we'll never
name.
Forget her, not only because she has a unique name, but because she was just a very, very amazing, she is a very amazing woman. I haven't spoken to her in a while. I should reach out to her. But I was in a combination third and fourth grade class. I was in the third grade, and not only in that class was she able to navigate the differences between third and fourth grade and help us learn from each other, but she was just incredibly inspiring.
I would have to say my third grade teacher, Miss Del Gercio, she was incredible. We're still Facebook friends. She was one of the people that really made me go from a person that was having a struggle with reading to somebody who can't put a book down, and that's still me today, and she's the reason why.
You know, the teacher that changed my life, probably my fifth grade math teacher. She had multiplication drills on the board, and she turned learning math into a competition, and I'm a fairly type A competitive person, and I wanted to win. And she kind of tricked me into making learning fun, and I always thank her for that.
I'm picking two because they were married. So it was my 11th grade honors English teacher, Ms. Doy, who was married to my 12th grade honors English teacher, Mr. Litton. They were fantastic teachers, and we read so many fantastic books, and it was two wonderful, memorable years in my education.
Well, I guess one was Mr. Ford, who was a history teacher when I was in middle school. I had him for 2 years, and he did that whole storytelling part and the respect he had, and you know, how he talked to kids and let them and taught them how to interact with each other. I think I learned a lot from that.
I had a couple. I had Mr. Thibault, my high school biology teacher. He was this little Frenchman, and he would defy us. he taught biology, and he would defy us to, I defy you to get, you know, 10 questions right about plant stomata, you know, and of course you'd take that challenge, but he was fun. He would do things like he wouldn't just tell us about diffusion. He would put peppermint oil in the sink and then ask us to raise our hand if we started to smell anything, you know, and so he would show us these things. And he really did bring that sort of magical wonder to things, and which was nice at a high school level, you know.
Just one? Gosh. Mr. Cantor, my high school drama teacher. I thought I wanted to be an actress. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, you don't.
Really?
And he was right. I think he knew, I don't think he thought, you know, you have a gift to be a teacher, you should go be a teacher. But he said, you know, the life is too hard. I think he was also trying to tell me I wasn't good enough, to be quite honest. Don't choose that. Find something else that really matters to you. So in a way that changed my life, because I might not be here today. I might be, you know, sending out headshots and going to random calls trying to get a job as an actress.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortega, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!